Well, welcome everyone to the March John Cain Luncheon. Just like to start by recognising that we meet on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people today, talking about land and housing, which is particularly resonant when we're thinking about our acknowledgement of country. And we pay our respects to elders past and present. Today we are really lucky to be joined by Dr. Cam Murray. Cameron has been commenting on housing in some shape or form for, what, 2 decades now? A long time. His background is pretty broad. He's got experience in planning offices, with property developers, in academia, and now he is the chief economist of the Fresh Economic Thinking is it a think tank or a group, or what would you describe
it's,
it as?
It's Australia's newest one-man think tank. Yeah. Go on fresheconomicthinking.com, put your email in, and you'll get an email that gets something.
Excellent. So, Cam has written a wonderful book, The Great Housing Hijack, in which he talks about some of the reasons why the debate over housing prices, and the type of housing that we get in Australia, why the debate over that is so muddled, why some people want to hijack it, what incentives there are, and what some of the solutions might look like as well. So Cam's going to talk for, how long do you think, 20 minutes or so? As long as you want. You've got time. Yeah. And then I'll jump in with some comments and we'll open up to questions. So if everyone keeps your burning questions to the end, that'd be fantastic. And then Emma Dawson will finish us off at the end to discuss next week's JCL. Okay, this one. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Cam. So everybody, if you could put your hands together for Cam Murray.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me, Matt, and inviting me down to Melbourne today. I see you've put on the cool weather for me. That's a nice break. A nice break for me from the Queensland heat. Why don't I start by reading the book, since I'm here? Chapter 1 is called Dwelling Dreams, and it starts with a very familiar line. Third and final call, the gavel drops, the auction is over. A busy day at the auction hall has seen more than 30 landlords bid for the right to rent their property to the young Jones family. The opening bid was $3,000 a month. At that price, the prospective landlords stood no chance. At this auction, all the landlords who gathered feared missing out on a tenant. Almost immediately, the landlord of a nearby property offered their similar home for $2,200 a month. A neighbouring landlord quickly responded. Then a third jumped in. After more than a dozen bids, the winning landlord offered their best price, $1,270 per month for a three-bedroom cottage, and won the auction to buy the Jones family as tenants at the lowest possible price. Like all auctions, the winner was stretched to their financial limit. The winning landlord offered a price that barely covered their costs, but it was a risk they thought was worth taking. All the properties at the auction had been inspected by the Joneses and were all of a high quality and a location they desired. The family knew that when the auction was over, they would have secured the home they want at the best price possible. The housing market worked. They were jubilant. But then the Jones family awoke. Cheap housing, whether renting or purchasing, is unfortunately just a dream for many young families, whether that's the great Australian dream, the Canadian dream, the American dream, the British dream. These deeply ingrained cultural aspirations are increasingly not matching reality. That story is there to get us, firstly, to switch our brains on by being a little unexpected, but secondly, it is there for us to think about the housing market and what we expect of it. Because you will find a lot of debates these days about the housing market and how we're going to make the housing market better and how the housing market is going to do this or that. But the housing market's never done what the Joneses dreamed it would do. Consider a quote from a celebrity visiting Sydney. This celebrity said, "The number of large houses just finished another's building is truly surprising. Nevertheless, everyone complains of the high rents and difficulty in procuring a house." That was not Taylor Swift in February 2020. What are we, 2024? Time flies. That was Charles Darwin in January 1836. On the first day in his diary when he visited on the HMS Beagle. Little changed. Fast forward to the 20th century. In 1910, the New South Wales government commissioned University of Sydney academic Robert F. Irvine to investigate the problem of rising housing rents. The report he produced in 1913 led to the 1915 Fair Rents Act in New South Wales. But little changed. 1919, the Interstate Commission conducted the Piddington Inquiry into rising housing rents. And there were many inquiries since. When they met to discuss after the Second World War, the key public Australian officials noted this about the housing conditions of the early 20th century. They wrote, "Cheap mean houses were built all around and between the factories, with no legislative restrictions to set even modest standards of space and light, or even the humanitarian considerations of health or privacy. Row upon row of workers' dwellings were jammed into every street. Land values rose with the high industrial potential. This was reflected in the rates and the added rents until this spiral of values reached a stage where one family could not afford one terrace home. These were then subdivided to cram more people in, and so began the overcrowding that exists today." We can also look, where's my other favorite quote? We can also look to the future of online game worlds. Lars Doucet is a game designer from Texas, and he explains that property bubbles, property busts, property recessions, and housing crises in online game worlds are nothing new. If this is the case, then it's a little bit puzzling to me that we expect the housing market to do something that we dream about, but throughout history, it has never done. That is a little bit of a confusion, which brings me to my main points that I actually want to talk about today. And there are two. Why? What is this housing crisis we think of, and why do we think the market is going to make it better? And secondly, what can we expect the housing market to do, and how can our policies change the outcomes? So let's do a little bit of audience participation. Are you ready for that? Did you get that on the email? No? I want to see by show of hands, who's a homeowner in the room? Hands up, keep them up high. Keep your hands up if you're having a housing crisis this year in 2024, worst of your living memory. Okay. Hands down, all the homeowners. Hands up, the renters. Keep your hands up if you're having the worst housing crisis in your memory. Quite interesting, isn't it? You can put your hands down. The housing crisis is not everybody's housing crisis. Typically, when I do this, we get around 2/3 or a little bit more homeowners, and almost all of them put their hands down. They're not having a crisis. And that represents what's going on out there. 2/3 of Australian households are homeowners. Very few of them paid the current price because they bought many years ago, and they're fine, they're not having a crisis. Usually, I get a few more renters, and I get about half of them keep their hand up. And that represents what's going out there in the broader community. Around 30% of households are renters in the private market, but only about half of them are really having problems with housing. So this housing crisis, if we think about all the households in the country, is a crisis for 1/3 of households. Yes, half of it, 1/6. Do the maths on the fly. For the other households, including the 18% of households who are landlords, we're seeing the best period for housing investment ever. And I think we've got to understand there's this deep symmetry at the heart of the housing market that is the reason why it's so hard to define what the housing crisis is. It is also why I argue that the debate is hijacked, because there are so many interest groups on both sides of this economic symmetry that seek to confuse because they don't want to be on the losing side if anything really does change. I surveyed my Twitter followers a few years back. It was actually only 1 year back. Gee, lots happened since. And this is what they said to me when I said, "What's wrong with the housing market today?" Some of them said, "There's too much density in the suburbs." Others said, "There's not enough density in the suburbs." Some said, "We must tax property more." Others said, "There are too many taxes on property." Some said, "There's too many investor buyers." Others said, "There's too few investor buyers for the rental market." Some said, "There's too many renters." And others said, "There's too few renters. We should have more renters." Some said, "We need tiny homes. That's going to be the solution." Others, "We need better homes." Some people said, "We need fast trains and transit infrastructure." Others said, "There's too much infrastructure waste." Of course, some people said mortgage rates are too low. And as you'd expect, others said the mortgage rates are too high. Some people said there's too many vacant homes. Some said there's not enough vacant homes. What do you notice? We all think the housing market is a problem, but we all think it's a problem for opposite reasons. And that is why we're in this debate that has been going on for not just 100 years, but 200 years in Australia about the price of housing. Our debate is hijacked by certain interest groups who don't want to be on the losing end if prices go down. They don't want to have a vacant rental property. They want to have a renter bidding against another renter or queuing up around the street and paying them a bigger income for their retirement or for their investment. So that's the story. I'm not going to get into the hijacked part of the debate. We know, for example, that politicians must be aware of this symmetry of property markets. They must be aware that if they were successful in making housing cheap, just 30% lower in price, getting nominal prices back to where they were pre-COVID, that would wipe $3 trillion off the balance sheets of two-thirds of their electorate. Something they would never do. When Lucy Ellis, who's the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank, was asked by the Falinski Inquiry, where are the examples of governments through policy changes orchestrating large declines in the price of housing assets and rental? And she said to that inquiry, there are no examples of governments making homes cheaper. They only get cheaper during economic recessions and depressions. And of course, when that happens, we do our very best to try and avoid it. It wasn't that long ago, just the second half of the 2010s, rents and prices were falling, and we did a lot of policy change, including monetary policy, to try and reverse that. So here's the question: what can the market do? What outcomes do we get from the market? In the book, I argue there are five important, what I call, equilibria. So in economics, there's this idea that when we trade, we get to an equilibrium outcome. And I'm going to just maybe discuss a couple of them because they're very relevant to the policy questions today. The first one is the asset price equilibrium. And maybe before I get there, I will just explain this idea a little bit more. When you're at the supermarket and there are two checkouts open and there is a queue at each one, if there's a queue of 10 people at one and two at the other, is that an equilibrium? It is not. Why? Because you can trade between Q1 and Q2, checkout one and checkout two. You can move and line up at the other one. And so when four of those people shift from that queue of 10 to the other one, there's six in each and there's no advantage from switching lines, right? And that's what we call an economic equilibrium. It's the market outcome of people's choices to trade so that there are no beneficial trades left in the market. Why do I say that? Because in our public debate about housing, we talk about things like, we will make house prices cheaper. How? Right? Houses are one of many assets in the economy, one of many supermarket checkout queues that I can take a dollar, I can take a dollar out of BHP shares and I can put it into housing, right? And if the price of housing went down, that means the yield, the income I get per dollar goes up. So everyone's going to switch out of those other assets and buy houses to push the yield, the price back up and the yield back down so that we're back at the equilibrium. So when I hear someone, oh, prices are called determined by supply and demand, I say, yeah, well, prices are also determined by the person who wrote the price on the contract, but that doesn't tell us about why that price was accepted by the seller and why that price was willing to be paid by the buyer. But do you know what does tell us? The equilibrium in asset markets when we can compare the cost of money by taking it out of other assets. So we can't just make property prices fall. That's why they fall during a recession or a depression, because the returns on all assets fall. Everyone becomes risk averse and the yields rise. So that's asset pricing. And they can't just go up either, right? Yields in Sydney, housing, Sydney housing, world's worst. They're 5%. That is, you buy a $1 million house, you get $50,000 of rent. Do you know what they were 10 years ago? 5%. Do you know what they were 20 years ago? 5%. If you study, and if you go on Google Scholar and look up studies with headlines such as the rate of return on everything over 500 years, where people have gone and they've looked at every asset class in the economy, they find that property makes the same rate of return as every other asset. It's slightly different in different years, of course, because everyone's trying to second guess and adjust, just like people might switch halfway through the checkout queue. But they always make the same rate of return and have done for hundreds of years. That also means that prices can't just go up, right? Prices are set by the behavior of trading within the broader asset market. So when people go, it's supply and demand, that's why. No, the prices are set in the asset market based on the rate of yield, which is the rental income. So the rental income, okay, but surely, right? Surely rents would go up because of supply and demand or whatever we're talking about. But the two supermarket checkout queues, there's an equilibrium there too. And maybe you won't believe me, but I can assure you this is true. In 2021, the typical renter household in Australia paid 20% of their disposable, their after-tax income, on rent. In 2011, the typical renter household in Australia paid 20% of their household disposable income on rent. In 2001, these were all surveys, the Survey of Income and Housing from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It was 20%. And in 1991, the first of those surveys, it was 20%. And in fact, if you go back to that 1911 rent inquiry in Sydney, you'll find that some of the analysis said rents should be about 20%, you know, 20% of a worker's salary is what the rents should be. So we've got this bizarre situation where, on the one hand, we've apparently got the worst crisis ever, and on the other hand, rents compared to incomes have been the same for perhaps a century, with a bit of a mid-century anomaly, but at least the last 40 years. So this is the other question about where rents come from. We can't just make rents go down, just like we can't just make prices go down. Because what happens when rents fall? People relocate into bigger and better houses. They take from their spending, they can either spend on non-housing goods and services or housing, and they take from this and they spend on that because their return's better. And over time, we move into smaller households, so fewer people per dwelling, bigger dwellings and better locations until we get to that 20%, where that trade-off of, oh, you know, I've got a nice car and a good job, should I move to a bigger house? Yeah, I'd have. But I won't go to a better house until I get a pay rise. You see what I'm saying? And across the market, that's the outcome we get. So we have a lot of talk about, you know, how to make rents cheap, but unless we can somehow limit those trades, just like how we must limit the trades in asset markets to change the price, the market will adjust and we'll spend 20% of our income on rents, and buyers of houses will pay based on the rate of return of other assets in the economy. So that's what the market can do. So we've got a lot of questions, policy questions, for example, where that sort of information is relevant. We talk about things like remove stamp duty and make prices cheaper. But we know a tax on buying an asset makes the asset worth less, not more. If I taxed you to buy BHP shares, $5 every time you bought one, BHP shares would be worth $5 less because you want to pay the same total amount to get that yield on the asset. So stamp duties make the sticker price of housing lower. What is another policy? We talk about immigration a lot these days, and it's true that temporarily immigration can change rents, but it's not true over time because we must adjust, right, by moving to different households and changing our location to spend that 20% of income on rents. So although, yes, there's a short-term disruption, just like there's a short-term disruption when incomes rise, we had record immigration in the 2010s and rents fell for 5 years straight, 20% nominally in some parts of Sydney between 2017 and 2022. So these are sort of the foundation ideas. I'm going to open it up for questions soon because I think it's more interesting, but when you all get the book, and I'm going to give this book to the best question from the audience today, because I'm an economist and incentives matter, you'll read about the three other equilibria, more about politicians and their own personal investments in property, the role of the media, and everything else you've ever wanted to know about housing. So I might just leave it there.
Can you just cover Housemate?
Housemate.
Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah.
You really want this book, don't you? So where does this lead me at the end of the book? Thanks for that, Matt. Yeah, let's wrap that up. The housing market is doing today what it's always done. This is predictable. In May 2020, during COVID, when we'd started decreasing interest rates and everyone was panicked about prices falling 30%, I said on a podcast, house prices are more likely to rise 20% than fall 20%, because you've got to understand the interest rate has come down and now it's much, much cheaper to swap out of other assets into housing. Or as I put it for home buyers, the price of renting money has gotten so cheap compared to the price of renting a house, I'm going to switch from renting a house into renting money with a mortgage. And that's what we did. We actually had record first home buying. We had essentially 5 years of first home buying in 2.5 years during COVID. So the market outcomes are predictable. Every part of the cycle, of course, the market's not steady all the time, it cycles. We get the same debates. We had them in the 1910s, the 1930s, the 1970s, the 1980s. We're having them again. When I looked around the world, I thought, well, we've got to be able to improve on this, surely. The places I found that had the best housing outcomes had large non-market housing sectors. So instead of my original point, we got 70% of people, but just about two-thirds, happy with the housing market, they're homeowners. Remember, and we've got one-third or 30% in private renters, and only half of them, right, are having a crisis. If we could build up, over a decade, a non-market home ownership or rental system, how I'm very open to the interpretation of it, but I love the Singapore model where you buy your house at a discount from the public developer and you can trade within that parallel system, because it outsources the management, it gives you the freedom and flexibility to renovate. There's no conflict between the incentives of the landlord, and the occupant. If we could build that up to 10 or 15% of the housing stock over the next decade, then in the next market cycle, in 20 years, when rents are rapidly rising as they are today, we'll solve most of the problem. Because remember, that's only that 10 or 15% of the market that's having a crisis. And if they have a better option, okay, of buying or renting from the public developer, the problem's solved. Now, people tell me, oh, this is naive, this is student politics, it's impossible. You're telling me the government can just build a million homes over a decade or two and get this share of people out of private rental? And I say, yeah, that of course we can. Sweden, after the Second World War, built a million homes in 5 years. Okay, Singapore, after independence, took home ownership from 20% to 88% in 25 years through their public home ownership system. We, after the Second World War, had massive public housing, and we took home ownership in the cities up from the early 40% to 71% by 1970, mostly through subsidizing people into buying their public housing off the government. So I think it's possible, and as I say to people, if we were debating schooling before the public schools system was created, and someone stood on stage and said, well, you know what I think the solution is to this high cost of education and this inequality of access, I think we should just build schools everywhere and let kids go for free. And you'd be called a crazy, naive student politician who doesn't know what they're talking about. And then we did it, and now we all think it's great, and we lobby for better spending, more spending, better schools, because it's, the system works. And I think it will be the same with Housemate, is what I call my proposed public home ownership scheme. But any implementation of that, I can imagine in 20 years our kids going, yeah, I want that opportunity. If I have to move to the city, I'm going to get a housemate and I'm going to live there because I know it's a good option for me. So that's where I get to. Look, if we could fix housing with tax tweaks, upzoning, I'd be there. I'd be talking about that right here, right? But there's no stamp duty in New Zealand and they're having the same conversations about housing, right? There's no little tax tweaks or upzoning that's going to do it. There were essentially no taxes when Charles Darwin wrote his diary. There was no federal government. There was no zoning. It was the same problem then. I'm going to stop and I'm going to ask for questions. Remember, a copy of the book is on the line. Let's do it. Thank you.
Good on you.
Thank you. Oh, thanks.